The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Here's Professor Seitz. And we're
going to,
we're here to answer any questions that you have. Anytime that you have any of us in the room, feel free to ask us anything you want. It could be about course advising, it could be about law school, or it could be about anything else. But we're basically all here to help you.
Questions.
I'm Ann Schell. I've taught here a long time. I've worked here in the law program. I'm a history student, so I've taught in the law, I've state, I've taught in the intellectual property community. I do lots of other things. So I'm Danielle Prime. I'm the associate director of the Women in the Law Center. And I also teach a course called Gender Equality in the State, which is about gender and domestic policy, and sometimes I teach a course called Gender and International
Law. And I'm Magdalena Saez, and I teach family law, which is business family law. I also teach comparative family law, and all the content I teach is going on in Spanish, all comparative law and introduction to the
So one of the things that we make you do is sign up for next year as you're trying to cope with ending this year, and maybe that's a good thing. And maybe it's good, but not well, that's what we do. And the Women in the Law program actually is really hard at trying to create a bunch of courses for you that make some sense. Different types of courses, what the different things are that the courses are meant to do. But so we're here to tell you a little bit about that and to really just answer your questions, which your questions will get us into all of what we see very abstract. We get kind of two levels of courses. We have courses that are specifically focused on gender, so we have feminist jurisprudence, or gender in the law, or domestic violence, although we could argue about that, but certainly about gender, even if it's not just about women. So we have a whole bunch of specialized courses that embed you in thinking about gender, and how gender involves relationship, and all the different aspects. Then we have a set of courses which are not specifically focused on gender, but are so bound up with gender that they're essential to what we do. So like family law. When I took family law when I was in law school, they said, what does that have to do with gender? Now we teach it like, how could you possibly think about gender and not think about gender? So we have that. Our employment is I mean, gender is so basic to the way the law has developed, and you think about the nature of discrimination, and they're just foundational courses. And then there are courses where they could be about anything, intellectual property, they could be about international environmental law, and it turns out they do have something to do with gender, and the way people teach them here bring in those issues. And so we try to give you some guide, some mapping of the curriculum so you have some sense of what's going on in the different pieces of the curriculum. And then we try to cover both domestic and international because it's in school and we can't ignore the rest of the world. We're part of who we are, which is not so usual in legal education, but it is just the way things are here. And then we try to balance things between fall and spring. So if you don't see things for the fall, we can let you know what's coming up in the spring. So and then we can answer general questions like, should I take courses for the law, or courses that I'm interested in, and things like that. So anything else that you can answer, sir?
So about that, so the way that Professor Charlotte describes how we think about our classes, much on this sheet of paper, just on put this out every semester, and you can actually find it on the Women in the Law Program website, as well as on my WCL, as well as kind of circulating around on these pieces of paper. All of this is the courses with the long descriptions are the ones that we consider to be sort of primarily focused on gender, and then you'll see on the back side, there are these two secondary categories, right? So we're talking about family law or, for example, employment discrimination courses where they have a good chunk, right? So it's going to be a week or two that means specifically addressing gender. And then down here are just faculty members who have asked us to put them on this list as either, you know, they cover stuff from a gender perspective or they're really open to exploring those issues and discussion in class, and even explicitly in the material, the professors are all really pretty comfortable doing that. And so that goes along the lines if any of you have ever looked at, you know, sort of what the UN does or what, you know, big organizations do with what we call gender neutrality, right? And it's where we try to integrate gender into all aspects of the curriculum in a different way, right? So sometimes it's really useful to have something very, very specialized, but sometimes it's more useful to start from the other way around. Start with an area of law and say, okay, so how does gender work in here? And so the classes, so you'll get one of these every semester for as long as you're with us. And usually it's roughly this number of courses. I have to say next spring, it looks a little heavier than this. It's a few more classes. And like Professor Shalek said, about half of them are domestic, half are international, and we try to make sure there are a couple of night classes in each semester as well for those of you who are night owls. And that's sort of the basic outline. The next way that we like to think about courses is that there are some really foundational courses where you sort of get the real vocabulary of gender and law, or you get introduced to the history of gender and law, or you get introduced to kind of the basic legal doctrine that underlies a lot of those issues. And so if you look at this sheet that has green logo on it, you'll see that we list four courses as what we kind of call foundational courses. Certainly, if you've never had a class in gender and language,
never took women's studies classes, this is a great place to begin,
right? And I'll give you the kind of confidence to move into the class. If you have a real background in women's studies or gender and law, this is also a really good place to begin because it will allow you to build on what you already know, right? So either way, and all of the faculty who teach these
four classes are looking to see if a student is new to the subject or really already has a pretty good background in it, and all the faculty know to work with students really specifically in both of those areas. And then you'll see that we kind of go moving forward. We have all of these advanced courses, and these are the classes that over the next 3 years are really likely to come up. Not everything is taught every semester. But I would say there's a, you know, better than 85%, 90% chance that all of these classes are going to show up at some point during your tenure here. Because these are the classes that our faculty are currently offering. So it's a little bit more up to date than the online course catalog, and a little bit more helpful in terms of, you know, navigating the kinds of classes that are offered. And these are broken out by substantive areas. So you can sort of target the things that. And then, of course, up here at the top, it always bears mentioning that we do have two clinics, and Professor Shaw will talk about that later, but two clinics specifically addressing gender as well as gender issues that come up in other clinics. Conrad, do you want to talk for a few minutes about family law and why it's sort of considered one of the foundational pieces of what we do, even though, again, it's not really a gender class?
Which is very interesting because I've never even thought of how we love what we do. I have a, well, yes, you can see from my accent, I'm not American. And that speaks a lot about how this law school is structured. I haven't seen many places in the United States so inclusive. Truly, truly inclusive, not just to view the rest of the world as but mostly as a real partnership. And
so I'm very fortunate.
This is the first semester I'm teaching family law here in the U.S. It's been a very interesting experience. And as I said, I really don't see how
family law can be not viewed as a gender bias. Not only because family has been linked to women as between part of the gender stereotype, as women must be the pillar of the family, but also if you want to challenge those structures, the first place to do it is challenging the structures of the family. So if you really want to start from there, you have to be conscious of the way your decisions have been, cases have been decided in family law are very interesting in terms of gender stereotyping. So placing women in particular places within the family and within society, it will give you a real idea of it's not only it would be very interesting culturally or sociologically, but it would really give you an edge in terms of how to challenge these structures, the societal structures that you think that should be challenged, or that you think that may not completely challenge, but at least something should be made to happen. So having a foundation in family law would give you a advantage. Not only you don't need to take family law only if you want to practice family law. I think that family law is a real foundation. It's a foundational fact for any area of the law. Given that actually family law is part of any area of the law, there's very little areas that I can think of where families are not impacted by the law. So actually, I think that the way that family law is structured so immediately shows the type of rigidity where women are placed. So you see the casebooks, so the casebooks sort of like I feel sort of tight inside the casebook myself in terms of the way that families, regulations of family law are structured. If I had my way, I think that family law should be about tax, property, and contracts, and our social welfare policy, and all those sort of things that really have a direct impact on family. So, as you can see, I enjoyed this semester a lot, and I hope that you have the possibility of taking some people at some point to be happy with what you have to do. And we have many wonderful people teaching. Real good faculty.
So, your questions, your thoughts, your musings, your confusions.
I think this felt better since we're speaking about history and history. Okay.
Well, they are profoundly connected to each other, and at some level, you can't do one without doing the other. And it's more of a question of entry point into so, as the title suggests, women's legal history takes you chronologically to the development of the feminist consciousness, of thinking about, well, not just feminist consciousness, but how you think about how women participate in the world and how you make sense of it at different periods of time. And oftentimes what comes with that are certain assumptions about what are the important categories we're thinking about. Think that in terms of equality. You think that are men and women equal at a different point in history? Or do you think that, well, how do men and women participate in society apart from whether or not their participation is equal? When you think about it historically, you think about it in terms of what is the power that men have and women have or don't have. How does the law affect that allocation of power? Each of those things I just said to you is in fact a branch of feminist theory. The first is equality theory. What's the theory of equality that operates when the law gets involved in framing a discrimination claim? How are two people similarly situated or not? And what matters in that? The second that I said, how do they participate differently? Well, are women, what does it mean that women are more often caregivers than men are? What does it mean that women enter the market in different ways than men do? what does that have to, how does the law regulate that or not? And what should that regulation look like? So that would be what we call care and connection feminism. It's a whole branch of feminist theory that looks at women's relationship to caregiving. And is that different than men's relationship to caregiving? And should it be? And is it biological? And what does it have to do with pregnancy? And should the law reflect that or not? And does that therefore affect how women participate in social institutions or not? So that would be another branch of feminist theory. The third branch is power. And there's a whole branch of feminism that looks at dominance. When is there male power and female subjugation? And how is that reflected in law? And how can law push back against that? And what are the consequences of that? Does it turn women into victims? And then there are about six others. So that you can approach it historically, or you can approach it from the different theoretical approaches to the law and then see how it, how you have to look at history. So, for example, in my feminist jurisprudence this semester, somebody from watching Downton Abbey got really interested in detail. Now, maybe you were not so interested in detail when you did it in your property class. Or maybe you were, but she is now interested in what are the, in the present, what does this mean in terms of women's control over access to property? It turns out that in parts of the world, I didn't even know this, if you had a detail, the law hasn't done away with it. It's probably a component. But
so left.
Well, you probably But anyway, so it's they're different entry points into these questions, sort of basic questions about how the law is structured and what are the categories that we think about.
I will say this also, Professor Clark, because you're doing legal history. A lot of it is very much about things like property ownership and voting rights and suffrage and the early rights to control one's family, to pass on citizenship to one's child. Those very those developments which occurred kind of earlier in our development of feminist history and other women around the world than in the United States. And so she does tend to end roughly somewhere around the 1970s. The early 1970s, at that moment of transition when the Supreme Court finally started to recognize sex as a protected category more specifically. And so it's really those early developments. Now that doesn't mean all the theoretical stuff is the same, right? We're still dealing with the same problem, the same question, right? So how do we allocate control over earning power? How do we allocate care? How do we deal with all of those things? But the time period in women's legal history is a little bit more limited, whereas in feminist jurisprudence it's a little bit more wide-ranging because the entry point is more theoretically driven rather than subject matter chronologically driven.
Just to get different versions. It's an insight into how this then turns into something post-curriculum. That in women's legal history, you'll do the suffrage movement and the the efforts to amend the Constitution as a social movement, as well as a legal thing that happened, and also as a conceptual thing. Voting was not just voting; it was a fight for citizenship, and it was voting as a critical indicia of being a full citizen. And so you'll see that both in theories of women and citizenship, but you also encounter it in immigration law. So how does becoming a citizen as an immigrant, how has that access to citizenship played out differentially in terms of gender? So who's entitled to bring a spouse in, who's presumed, what do you do to prove citizenship? So the notions of gender is in attaining citizenship through immigration are profound all over the place, as well as for parent-child relationships. So you start to see that we've got these things all over the curriculum.
You mentioned that the foundational courses are suggested before going on if you haven't taken
them. Not before. You can do it
any time.
Old subject, okay. And then go back to the foundation. That's actually the way my mind works better.
Okay, so like looking at the courses in the back is not...
It's not like advanced, you don't have
to. Okay, there's no prereqs or anything. Okay. Now, and sometimes it's actually really useful to have taken a class, and then you go back and you're like, oh,
that's what was going on.
So we can't say, and so it really, in part, is about how you learn, right? Do you go big picture to little picture, or is little picture to
big picture better? And honestly, in part, it's just what it is.
So I wouldn't worry about it at any point
along the way.
You know,
we put you through the grinder the first year, so we know you know how to read, we know you know how to, you know, think about cases,
and now we're going to sort of make you look now.
Find the courses that sort of meet how you learn.
I had a question, like, more generally, based on the fact that a lot of these courses are small, which is great. But in terms of wait lists and things, like, I don't know how that works at all because no one's explained it to us, I don't think. And I know at my college, like, if you showed up to class that day, you know, you might have a shot of getting into class.
It's the same thing. My list that I get from the registrar and the year and the other level course, I wouldn't say that it's randomly related to who actually but there's about a 50% overlap between who eventually ends up in class and who's on that initial list, which is partly the vagaries of how people sign up for classes and why they sign up, and it has to do with schedules, and I like this time block where there's this conflict between these two classes, and you don't get into one that you want, but you wanted to, or you don't like the professor, and then you end up in something else. So just go.
So the official rules are that people have to come in order off the wait list. And that is true. But what we find is that because people are allowed to register for as many units as they want, most people register for far more units than they're ever going to take. Plus, a fair number of students register for classes and then get an externship. Right? I mean, if you had an opportunity to go work at a court for the semester, you would take it. And suddenly, you just up, you know, 4 or 5 classes behind, right, for other people.
And so what we find is that if you really want to take a class,
there are occasional classes that really, the wait list, you know, is 50 deep and you're really not going to get in. But if the wait list is, you know, 10, 12 deep, chances are if you go on the first day, the professor will take a class for you. Now, they can't let you in before somebody else is off the wait list, and that sometimes feels a little bit unfair because in a college class, oftentimes your mere presence kind of bumped you up to the top of the wait list. That doesn't actually work, and the registrar is pretty strict about that. So it's not exactly the same as in college, but Professor Shaw is absolutely right. I have very, very rarely seen a situation where a class was just entirely closed off. It does happen, so I'm not going to say it's impossible. But, you know, and sometimes things do happen. So, for example, last semester we had a class where the wait list was just so long I could tell it was...
We weren't going to let everybody in, and we actually opened a new section.
So, you know, keeping your name on the wait list...
You can get a new section.
It can actually get a new section opened. And so, you know, we are listening. We are responsive. And if there's a flood of students in a particular area, sometimes it feels kind of random to us. You don't know what everybody is doing until the last minute. So to just stick with it if you really, really want a class. And also remember that you're going into your
freshman year and
you will have a lot of classes in that if you're out. Or
a very similar class.
Right? So sometimes a class isn't offered every year, but that's because there are two that are
taught by different faculty members and we swap them off.
But they're close enough.
What's a faculty member who teaches different courses, but the overlap of what that faculty member is really interested in is enough that for what you want out of it, unless it's something really, really, really specific, and say, well, okay, you couldn't get into trafficking, but you can get into gender migration and gender labor migration. And it turns out that those really have an enormous overlap, and you might not know it.
Come talk to us.
So it's one of the advantages of having a woman in the law program that actually really focuses on the curriculum, that if a lot of students want to take something, we will advocate. And it's not that the associate deans don't do that, they do care, but they're looking at the whole curriculum. And so we can do that in a much more focused way and say it's not just numbers, but really ourselves.
So we might not be able to solve the problem right away, but we do try. So let us know if there are really things that you want to take and really not getting into. We'll see what we can do. And then there are always workarounds for all kinds of things. And so I can't get you into a class that's straight up closed, but I can often find similar situations for you. So if you find yourself stuck, come and see me, and I'll see if I can brainstorm another option for you. Because lots of times there are other classes, there are independent studies, there are externships, there are other placements that could get you the same skills.
Are there any non-gender focused courses that you see?
Like what?
Especially family law?
Well, here are my two. Nobody ever listens to me. And they actually have almost nothing to do with practicing just family law, practicing law, their administrative law, and government. And the reason is actually the same for both of them, which is that they are enormously counterintuitive. So it could be that in practicing family law, wills, trusts, and estates will substantively be more useful when you do a family law practice. You would have some clients, but you know what? Who can, if you, particularly if you take the clinic, but you'll be able to learn wills, trusts, and estates, especially if you're interested in it. There are lots of fascinating questions. There are lots of people who teach it. There are lots of materials. You'll know how to learn it. It's really hard to learn administrative law and federal courts on your own because the law makes no sense until somebody tells you why it makes sense. There are just counterintuitive things in both of those areas. And administrative law, particularly domestic, is critical. Family law, it overlaps with so many areas of administrative law. So any kind of public benefits you want. If there's any kind of regulation of employment, if there's any kind of regulation of childcare, if there's any kind of, I mean, you're just dealing with a regulatory environment. If you have four clients, I mean, their lives are governed by multiple regulatory systems. And so understanding what a regulation is, what regulation has to do with a statute, what a proposed regulation is, why it would matter, all of these things are just really basic to any, particularly to family law, but really any area of practice. You might have some. And then, but also, as with any other course, take them from somebody who will be a great foundation will be a good person to be.
Yeah, and usually I would say also, if you're interested in family law in this country in particular, you have to say immigration. It's very
and
I would also stress that it's
so important.
I also second suggestion in terms of it doesn't matter so much the name of the class, but who teaches a class. So sometimes you have like really dramas, names. But maybe the faculty will not be as generally or something like that, or other options that you might think of. So look at the evaluations if you're taking a class. And sometimes classes look very dull because the name is so boring. But
like
administrative
law.
Like administrative law.
But then you have faculty
who will can make a really boring class very fabulous, and it might change the idea of what you wanted to do. So don't get stuck with the name of the class.
Do you research who you look to see to it, what the evaluations are, and try to find from
students in the past,
what they thought about the class, those things
help you.
And then as you think about next year and your third year, if you want to practice in family law, because it's a very client-focused area of practice working with one client. And to some degree, it doesn't actually matter which one. And they will all tell you that they all end up dealing with family law in one way or another. So it's not just the women in the law clinic or the domestic violence clinic, the civil practice.
Yeah, actually, they have the most family law cases. And so
really getting experience in things like interviewing clients and doing an intake and working with clients to figure out what their goals are and what they want out of the situation is crucial for a family lawyer. Family law is difficult in
one particular way,
which is that unlike most areas of private practice, there are not big law firms that do a lot of family law. There are a couple large law firms with family law units, but very few.
Most family law practitioners are in very, very tiny little firms or solo practitioners,
and oftentimes they don't actually they don't have the resources to hire interns, to pay interns. And they can't take externs because they're not a nonprofit, which is you get to be part of the externship program. And so it can be a little bit challenging sometimes to find ways to
get the experience that you want.
Doing family law at the clinic is really an ideal place to go because you can actually get experience doing the client contact that you want, and then that will help you. And there are other things that you can do if you're interested in trying to get experience doing family law. Most of those are going to be volunteering. Which I highly recommend that you do as part of the Pro Bono Honors Pledge or some other kind of volunteer system. We can talk more about that too. But just know that it's going to make your entry into the world of work slightly different than those of your friends who are looking at firms or at public interest law. It's actually its own very specific niche. And I will say that most of the people I know
practice family law
actually got experience doing some other things all the while trying to get break into family law. So it can be,
yeah, but the people who practice family law, who love practicing family law, love their jobs.
Also, it's an area of practice which in this environment is pretty stable.
Yeah.
It's not exploded because, you know, basically people have the same, you know, there are a few cases about what happens in petri dishes. But that's not where most of family law is. It's, I think, people getting divorces and child support and custody and
public benefit.
It's in all of that stuff. And it just kind of goes on, even with the economy and the legal profession going haywire. And so, in some sense. And so, for example, one way into a family law practice would be, you know, you do an externship with one of these organizations, like an immigration organization, Tahi Reed, which does trafficking cases and does violent women act cases and does legal permanent rape. It does all kinds of asylum cases, almost all of which have to do with families. And then you go and you do that as an externship within, like, Professor Popper's administrative law externship. And you get some administrative law from Professor Popper, who understands the intersection of family and administrative law. And then you do the clinic. And boy, are you ready to go out and do family law practice after that.
The other thing that I've got is the importance of
Learning how to argue and find the best argument. So, for example, not only you have to study constitutional law, for example, it's really important that you
review constitutional law,
but also
try, if you're going to
whatever
class you're going to take, make sure that you understand the basis of how to argue your arguments,
your best arguments, and why you have the best arguments. It surprises me sometimes how difficult it is for some students
to understand the
argumentation
part
of the case. It's not a story, you're not
talking about a story that something happened in a particular thing.
You're trying to understand what was the best argument,
what's the argument, what was the argument that won,
and that is something that you need to learn
how to do in your head.
So
make sure that whatever class you take, you understand that whether you're going to be litigating or not, you have to understand how to make your case.
Whether you're going to be talking to a client, and you need to make sure the client understands what would be the best
argument for her.
Or whether you're going to convey those arguments to convey your client to others, you need to understand how arguments work.
And that's really important.
It's so interesting, because in law school, I only say we teach that. And the rest of the world says, oh, law students, they're so argumentative. They're so belligerent. They're always... It turns out one of the hardest things we find in clinic is actually to get people to be zealous advocates. It's really scary. I think what we end up teaching you in law school is respect for authority and deference for authority. what does the case say? Oh, what did the judge say?
Rather than,
what is this idiotic interpretation that they just came down with? What are my 20 ways to go after this? Right? We don't very effectively
teach you that.
Because it's hard to grade it on the exam, and it's hard to get people to know. It's hard to so grading on exams tends to drive what we teach, and so anyway. You have to find other ways to particular upper level courses or clinics to get at what Professor Seitz is talking about. How to think creatively, how to think dynamically about the law, how to think about lawyers who make the law, it's not judges. Judges don't know what to do unless lawyers tell them what to do.
Yeah.
Judges don't know what arguments they have to face unless lawyers. I mean, it really is. It's not that legal movements and lawyers operating shape the law much more. I mean, an individual judge has enormous power in his or her courtroom, but it's a different kind of power than the power of creatively and dynamically shaping the law. So that's Trump is fun, and it's good to take, but we shouldn't take so light if you don't want to.
I mean, as litigation,
there are all kinds of ways to think about argumentation other than trial ed. I have students who think between trial ed and the clinic, and that for some of them it's great. They don't overlap very much, although you can do the same thing. Some people, they just felt like they ought to take trial ed. And again, you can, when you graduate, you can learn. There are a million good trial ed programs out in the world, just like the millions of programs on
Bill's Trust and Estates.
So you should take it if you want to take it, and it would be fun for you, and it would be interesting for you to do.
Don't force yourself.
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to say is more of the way that you should face any class that you want to take.
You can
see yourself in the world as defeating an argument,
or you can see yourself in the world as a lawyer
using bad arguments and making them good,
and
seeing, you know, a decision is not good or bad because you
like the outcome.
Many times we are fortunate to have decisions that we like the outcome, but the rationale is so poor that the life or the rights are hanging on a thread, which is what happens to me personally with law, which I think that
it's because it's about decision. Though I may like the outcome, but it's always
there, and this country is so much divided.
on that topic. But it has to be in terms of arguments that could have been better. And so what I'm saying is that you have to make sure that when you face your classes, you don't have to just settle saying, this is what the case says. You can challenge what the case says. And as Professor Chen is saying, so there are judges who are just decisions that are not good, that could have been better. Maybe they are good, but they can be better. So whatever you're going to take, make sure that you come with it. Sometimes even the most theoretical class will give you that possibility of argumentation. You don't, you feel that you have trouble finding, recognizing a bad argument from a good argument, maybe a class like jurisprudence will really make a difference. And that I know, I love jurisprudence. I think it's the best topic to always take, and it should be sort of the foundation of law. Needless to say, first jurisprudence is the segue. You can't go out without knowing, without being learning from jurisprudence. Now, I have a rare approach because I bought animal from a tradition. That is that I believe that the way that you learn to think is thinking on theory of law. So that's why I think jurisprudence and jurisprudence are good foundations to learn how to argue, how to understand the rationale of argumentation.
Also, you know, something like critical race theory of the theory courses, intersections, overlaps of race and gender are so important in the screen. And again, as Professor Sides says, it's another place where you think about argumentation, where you think about the structure that the law has given to a particular area, and how over time people have challenged that and have used people's experience in order to transform the law in really interesting ways, or have run up against terrible barriers and will understand, you know, if you take critical race theory, you understand all kinds of defects of common law that only seem abstract and doctrinal and theoretical.
So in terms of the skills
classes that are simulation classes, so other than big bench or clinic, classes like trial ad and those sorts of things,
the only students I really strongly advise to take this class are students who have a real problem with
one of those aspects, right?
So if you're
absolutely petrified at standing up in front of someone making an argument,
sometimes you need to take a class that plays to your weakness, not to your strength. We're all, you know, once you're in like elective land, you're like, oh, I'm going to take things I'm good at. Sometimes you ought to take something that you're actually not that great at in a safe environment, right? This is a friendly law school, and no one's going to be very, very mean. And so if you actually feel as though that's something that you worry a lot about, it might be good to find a safe environment to work on those skills, because that's what we're here to help you do. So that's kind of the one caveat.
Be careful about the engagement report stuff. It's a time suck. And some of the competitions are well designed, and many of them are terribly designed, but that can't be pedagogical. It's true, the rules for them are absolutely wrong if you want to be a good advocate. So, for example, any competition in which you can't reshape the facts and frame your argument, well, that's what appellate lawyers do. They reshape the facts. You're given a factual statement, you probably should not do that in the first competition. Because writing your factual statement is the most important part of writing the brief. So, a student, how is a student supposed to know that? They move court to court to court, and you want to do the First Amendment. And I'm not saying the First Amendment is bad, probably the First Amendment is good. But, you know, so that, but don't just assume because it's going to give you a chance to argue.
That's a good use of your time,
right? Because their time sucks, and they can be worth it because they're very interesting and fun, and they can be fun and engaging. Awfully, awfully frustrating. Stop.
foundational course that
we have is not especially theoretical unless
the human's orientation in that section of discrimination. So that's going to be more of a statutory interpretation.
Not sort of the one that anchors in the spring.
So that's primarily the advanced part of the constitutional structure as well as statutory interpretations in 10.7, 10.9, and probably kind of fair housing stuff as well. And so that sort of is a nice place to go in the spring. There are also some international courses which are also good.
The course on gender, cultural differences, and
human rights is an entry point also for if you're a little bit more international. I do know that critical race theory is, I believe, going to be offered in the spring, and that would be, if I could pick on this theory, I would pick critical race theory, because you're going to get a lot of the same theoretical entry points, again, slightly different framing, but
the exercise is the same, right?
Yeah. Getting you to see the law from a theoretical perspective rather than just a doctrine perspective, kind of this law of this.
Good arguments come precisely from an expression, baseball, something whatever.
Baseball? Out in left field?
Left field. Since I have no idea about baseball, but something. But yeah. The best arguments are the ones that you never saw them coming. And for those, for you to have those, you really have to take those classes that challenge the mainstream of the legal system. Why is it that we have the things that we have them now? Why is it that we can't have them differently? Why is it that families start with marriage? Why is it so important to know?
Why is it that we devote so much weight to marriage couples versus non-marriage couples?
What is out there that makes marriage so important?
If you don't really take classes that
will make you study those challenges, it will be very difficult for you to really, you will just go with the flow.
You keep on seeing the flow as
are to see the book. So it's good to have those challenges and critical race theory.
Those are the classes that will teach you
that sort of put those other glasses in where you see, where everybody sees normal, you'll see something different.
And our two people who teach critical race theory, Professor Hutchison and Professor Emerson, both do a good dose of gender and sexuality. So they give you the theory train won't be there.
Is there a difference between the jurisprudence classes, 2 credits versus 3 credits?
In the feminist jurisprudence?
Yeah.
No, everybody does the same thing, it's the length of the papers, And you get to choose up to the last unit. You can switch back and forth as many times as you want.
So as you change your mind and decide,
right. So sometimes it helps people feel less crazed
So, for example, I had a student who was doing a comment on hostile work environment in Title VII and the EEOC decisions on workplaces that were particularly hostile to women. So it's in workplace work. Could you say that it's a hostile working environment when you went into it knowing what kind of place it was? So the law was all over the place on that. And what she had to write for her comment was like all of this parsing the doctrine and this circuit and this district court and that district court. So what she did in feminist jurisprudence was talk about different theories of social construction of gender and how the social construction of gender operates in the people in general and the social construction of gender. But she ended up feeling a little more sane.
But the other sort of writing piece is that seminar classes on 50% credit options are going to probably disappear over the writing program. Which you will all need to knock out at some point. And gender classes, most gender classes are paper classes, not all of them, but for the vast majority, and so they're great places to get that knocked out. And
almost, I don't know any professors who won't let you bump up the number of pages.
Okay. So if it's a 20-page paper, they will let you bump up the ten pages to get your upper level writing requirement.
I think that's what I got mixed up with.
Yeah, and that is very, very possible to do. The courses like feminist jurisprudence are designed to be a good place to do that. And a mistake that a lot of students make is to kind of leave that off until the last minute, and then you find yourself writing, you know, either an extra paper or trying to use your comment, which is just a bad idea. So I strongly advise people to pick a seminar, write a paper, get the requirement done, and then you don't have to get turned into the paper, and you don't have to do that again.
And you don't have to fight tons of professors if you do that. Even the professor will make you do something different than the law review editor is, and then you'll go crazy, or the professor will just sign off on it, and
then you won't learn anything.
So it's a system we've got to fix.
Yeah. Professor Clark's Women's Legal History is another place for a lot of people, which is a great place to do your upper level writing requirement as well. She's very amenable to that.
I need to allow it to say it's a seminar, it's not like the family law class.
It's all comprehensive. So it's more of a seminar on comparing ideas and structures of family and how. Basically, it's
the study of how sex and blood relate to family in different
systems. So it's a different thing, but it's a good
it's a good class for an upper level writing.
I went to one of those OCPD talks about applying for federal government for 2 months summer, and they stressed that your fall semester should. And I mentioned women's legal history, and I got the Save That for Spring. And I want to see you guys on the
There are so many
questions.
Please
just roll your
eyes. I have the OCPD. I mean, this is like the faculty and the staff here are not on the same page. And so just you have to use your judgment about what makes sense to you. I have never had a student get a job because they've taken serious classes, ever. Courses that you're interested in, that you talk in sophisticated ways about, that show that you thought about the kind of work that you will be doing, a kind of cover letter that frames those things in good ways, that picks out things that are distinctive about you. The hard courses are totally non-distinctive. Nobody's going to give you a job because you're taking the Ministry of Law. I told you you're taking the Ministry of Law. Nobody, because everybody in the whole world takes administrative law or evidence. So, no. Show what makes you distinctive. Give them
So what kind, what area in the federal government do you want to go into?
Labor? Probably health or...
Then take health courses!
So we have a class on...
we will have a class next spring on gender health and the law.
And so if you were to write a paper in that class
on, you know, something in that area, that makes an application
stand out, right? Because you say in particular, oh, I wrote my paper about, you know, the FDA's approval of Plan B and, or, you know,
whatever it was, right? All kinds of areas like that. So looking, for example, take
women's legal history, for example, the regulation of women's bodies and women's health is a huge
part of the development of feminist consciousness, if nothing else, but certainly feminist theory.
So how did early birth control regulation come into being? Right? How did we start regulating something that was previously
unregulated?
How did the legal changes happen around that? And it was long, long, long before Roe versus Wade, right? This was,
you know, much, much earlier.
And so you can then say, you know, one thing that you really want to demonstrate to any employer is that you're really, really, really interested in what it is that they do. And that's, and writing a paper about it in a seminar is one way to show that, and you should absolutely talk about those things in the cover letter. That, you know, I'm really interested in this. I wrote a
paper about it. Shows how excited I am about what it is that
any picture I have, put it on your resume.
Right.
Rather than having it in this team. Some professor was saying to me that the advice somebody had gotten from me was that students need three languages in addition to English. One of them was Korean and another was Japanese, and it was like listed at the bottom of the resume and it wasn't in the cover letter. And the student wanted to work on international financial transactions, and it wasn't like in the top sentence, in the top sentence of the cover letter. Listed at the top of the resume. I mean, you know, you figure out how to do it. If your resume looks like everybody else's, if all the interesting stuff is buried, you're not going to stand out.
And the other thing is that when you're passionate about something, it's much easier to get a good grade. So, and really, employers do look at grades, unfortunately.
Yep.
If I had my way, we would have this possible. But in
this is not my world, it's, you know, somebody else has made it, you have to
take what you want, get the good grades.
But yeah, be passionate about what you're doing.
It will be much easier to get a good grade, it will be much easier also to show that you care about what you're really trying to get a job on.
So I understand what
whatever the office person is.
They try really hard with a very small office and a very bad time, and they're doing the best thing.
Nice people. But it doesn't work for everyone. It's, you know, if everybody's pushing and knocking on the same door, you know, chances are that just one or two will get into that door.
And
one,
oh, yeah.
My last thing about that is that if you want to get a job in a particular field of law, take your cover letter and your resume and go to
the office hours of the faculty members who work in that area of law.
Make an appointment, send them your stuff. I am always happy to look over at letter and say,
you speak three languages? Let's put that at the top, right? Because I did hiring when I was at a law firm, right? Like, I've done this before, right?
So, so talk to the faculty who are in that specific area. Those of you who never did hire us yet,
you know, an FDA regulatory compliance, you know,
unit in a law firm, but maybe my background.
I was also, you guys talked about, like, externships before. And this is going to sound like too much of a good thing, but I do have a lot of interaction with students who are older than we are, and we've done these things. And if you have an externship offer, but you've also gotten, like, Journal and or Marshall Brennan and or, you know, other things, like, when does that stop? Like, when should you just be like, maybe I shouldn't do an externship, like, cut yourself off and say, like, maybe next semester to, you know, the organization that has
work-life balance
stuff. Right now.
I know.
That's not right. I feel like it works.
I'm sure.
Right? Yeah, you absolutely are just going to have to, at some point, prioritize.
Yeah.
Really, what you want to do is think about what skills you need to develop.
secretary or your aunt general, wherever it is, who offered you a position that might actually change your life, versus complaint and saying, this is what I think I want to do, and these are the steps that I'm going to take, because I want to work in public policy someday. I should probably get some Hill experience. How am I going to get that? And, you know, all those little baby steps along the way. And so you're right, their intention. And so the way that you know is exactly that. Does this either seem to present a really unique opportunity that I'm not going to be able to replicate in some other way? Somebody who's really opened the door for me and gone out of their way to open that door for me, and who's really just versus these are the really specific skills that I'm trying to work on right now, right? As I'm building myself into a more experienced player. So it's an interesting call. But those are the things to think about. And there will always be another way to develop a specific skill or a specific assessment area. But there's no, like, one time on the chance unless I get the offer to job on the Supreme Court and turn them down or something. But until that happens.
I mean, I'm planning on
it. If that's fine. But so if they offer it to you, go ahead and say yes. I'll deal with the Senate confirmation hearing. But sure to that, chances are there are going to be other ways.
Mm-hmm. Also, your passion and what you're interested in, it will help people staying in the rest of law school. So if you want to be Marshall Brennan because everybody who you respect has done it and loved it, the chances are you will love it. And the externship, the good externship will be there at another time.
No, it will be. We'll find it. Washington's a great place to be for that. And just, I think that
3 years
go by very, very quickly.
Yeah, and there's a reason why.
You can tell now.
There's a reason why those system of
law school are very involved in law. I mean, it not always was like that. This was a system that started with apprenticeship. But if you move to a system with this time. So make sure that whatever you do,
you have time to study.
Not only because you want to have good grades, because pragmatically you need good grades,
but because
you decided to study law because you feel that there is something important there. And the good lawyer is the one who knows to study, not the one who just passed by doing tons of little things and doing about 1,000 bad things
sort of fully done. So make sure that you really have time to study. And I'm not saying, and I'm not...
I never was the kind of student who was just studying.
So I would never advise someone just to study.
But make sure that you have time to really learn, to not focus on studying, more focus on learning. You are learning what you're doing.
Thank you. Any other
questions?
I got
an
answer. Thank you so much.
Enjoy.
Thank you. We love having you here.
We love doing this stuff.
Oh, can I ask who Phoebe Davis is? The woman from the law? Is that like a...
That's
professor.
Brenda.
Why did I say Davis?
Yeah,
Davis.
Professor Smith.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's a fabulous professor. She is one of the clinical faculty,
okay,
which is why she's not down in the first year. Too, but I just haven't met her yet.
Yeah.
But she's wonderful, and it's a wonderful class. And speaking of upper level writing requirements, her goal in this course, and it's a year long course, you know that, like, you must be really serious. Her goal in the class is for you to emerge from that class with a piece of publishable writing. And having a piece of
publishable writing is super awesome on your resume, right? Like, that looks good.
Especially, a piece of publishable writing also needs to read the writing, right? Because it's been over and over and over and over it with the help of a professor, and she co-teaches it with the librarian. So you want to learn, like, intensive, like, research skills, go spend a couple of Saturdays with the librarian. Right? Like, those are the people who know, right? And that's what employers are looking for. Employers want people who really know their way around the research library and really know how to write. So if you have any interest in criminal justice issues at all, if you're interested in critical race theory at all, and if you have an interest in gender,
employment, she does a lot of people who work in prison.
seminar. That one is one I have to say, go get that.
That does close out.
Sure.
And
that's one of those classes that, you know, it's really professor specific, so I can't just say, like, oh, open up another section. Somebody else can do that awesome thing. She puts her heart and soul into this
class. You might just get lucky.
So definitely put yourself down to that course. Hopefully, it'll be awesome. Yeah. Okay. You've mentioned a couple courses that you can use to get your upper level writing requirement. I was wondering if international trafficking.
They're not doing it this semester, but I believe Professor Schwong has done a paper in the past. So.
Yeah, and actually a similar course, which I know does have a paper, is Professor Schwong teaches a seminar, sometimes called Gender
Labor in the Global Economy. Hopefully we will offer that in the next year or two.
And that's most definitely.
Also just, okay. You know, if you shoot me an email, I can find out what Professor Schwong's comments are.
Okay.
The other person who does a lot of papers who's not here this year but should be back next year is I guess we call up. So we did EU law, if we did
comparative law.
Comparative law. I'm not sure which what ones are coming up next year.
Anything
government law.
If you did local government law, you could do, like,
how local regulations affect food safety programs.
Yeah.
So, you know, who would know that local government law would be a gender course? But it will be, I promise you. It will also be a race course, and it will also be a theory course, so.
Before you guys run out, if anyone is still looking for either internships or externships for the summer or for next fall,
this is just a running list that we're keeping. Places that other people have found jobs in a fairly recent past, and a list of a couple of websites.
If you're interested in gender, the DC the Legal Aid Society, the District of Columbia is a terrific place. Grand City is a terrific place. I mentioned to Gary before that they're both terrific. I knew them. We've had many students who have been really good externships there. Come talk to us. I mean, there's still places that are looking for externs. So, you know, I feel hopeless. Some of the best things open up late, particularly for the best places, because they don't have the energy to do it in January and offers or hiring.
And women have a lot of people that you're looking for at Inspire the Summer, right?
Yes, I'm looking for Inspire the Summer. So,
yeah, as am I. And we are not looking for yourself, but we'll be looking for one for the fall.
So all the information is online at UCL, so just go on there.
Yeah, and check the Women in the Law program listserv, please.
Sure.
But the intelligence related to gender and actually next fall, the first week of school, we have a gender reception. So come.
I actually just talked to somebody the other day who's one of my three lawyers in all of Maryland who's handling foreclosures. So if you're interested in doing foreclosure work,
I know, right?
I mean, it's terrible. They're interested in having students who want to work on foreclosure stuff.
Anybody who wants to work on